Welcome to Inside Whitehall with me, James Starking.
And me, Jonathan Gullis. Well, today we have a very special guest indeed. We have Councillor Abby Brown, now OBE as well. So congratulations on that.
Thank
Abby.
You.
Abby has served as a Stoke-on-Trent City Councillor for a very long period of time now, 14 years and 1 month, I think it is roughly saying on your LinkedIn, for the Mere Park Ward. And during that time, Abby has obviously been the leader, essentially, of the opposition, then deputy leader of the council when there was a coalition with the then City Independents, and then in 2019 to 2023 became the leader of Stoke-on-Trent City Council, and actually the first Conservative in a very long time, if I'm not mistaken, to actually lead that local authority.
Yes, only the second ever Conservative leader of Stoke-on-Trent City Council. Longest serving, I did 4 years. The previous Conservative leader did 12 months, a pretty difficult time.
There we go, so record-breaking, which is great news.
Me. Yeah.
And then actually, in that time, Abby's also now become on something called the Local Government Association, and also known as the LGA, for those who like their acronyms. She's actually the deputy leader of the Conservative group on the LGA, which is an elected position within the LGA as well, and has also now taken up a directorship on the board of Localists, which is a think tank predominantly around local government. So who better to talk about local government? And what a timely time to do it,
yes,
when we are
absolutely
coming up to local elections, mayoralties and so forth. So we always like to start off by asking people about their journey into politics.
Okay.
How they got there. I know it, obviously, because we've worked together a lot and you've been stuck with me now for four and a half years.
At least, yeah.
At least. So we're keen to know, why enter the crazy world of politics?
So, short story, I grew up in North Staffordshire. I've always lived in North Staffordshire. Don't come from a political family. I wasn't handing around vol-au-vents as a small child, but there was always lots of discussion around current affairs. My dad had a little garage in Stoke, and my mum worked in a local school as a teaching assistant. So there's always lots of current affairs discussed. And we were a Conservative family, I guess you would say, albeit not activists or party members or anything like that. I was encouraged at school to continue my interest in current affairs. I did politics at A level, politics at Staffordshire University, fantastic university based in Stoke-on-Trent. And then I went on to do a master's degree in Keele University. And really at the end of that, I thought, well, you know, I've really enjoyed this, doing politics, but I don't want to be an MP, just go and get a kind of a normalish job. However, I ended up working in the former Shropshire County Council as a political assistant, working for the Conservative group, who were in opposition. Really enjoyed working with councillors, learnt lots about local government over the 4 years that I was there, and for the first time met aspiring MPs, a number of whom are your colleagues now. And I really enjoyed that, watching them campaign and eventually take their seats. I left that to go and work as a voluntary agent for Jeremy Lefroy, who then later became the MP for Stafford, but he didn't win. So when he didn't win, I went to work for him in 2005 when he ran for Newcastle under Lyme. I basically started my family, sat at home for a bit. But as is the case often in political parties, people remember you. And one day, an old friend of mine who was a party agent called me and he said, I want to introduce you to somebody. This guy's got involved in Stoke-on-Trent Conservatives. I know you still live in the area. It'd be really great if you kind of get involved. So I went along and I met this guy. He was working in a ceramics factory. We hit it off straight away. That turned out to be Gavin Williamson.
Oh.
He and I remain to this day good friends. Gavin was the chairman in Stoke-on-Trent Conservatives. We were one of the first federated Conservative associations in the country. And I got involved through him. I didn't want to stand for election. Gavin eventually persuaded me I should do. I lost the first time, which had quite a big impact on me, in a ward that we should have held. And I was, obviously I was a candidate, so I wasn't technically beaten, but the person who won in that ward was a BNP candidate.
Hey.
And this was at the moment when Stoke was having a rise in the BNP. Had the second, joint first largest group of BNP councillors in the country. And a number of my friends in the ward were saying to me, but we thought you were going to win, Abby. What went wrong? And you just think, well, I didn't probably campaign hard enough, whatever. But I wanted to go again. So 2 years later, I stood and I took my seat in 2010 for the Mere Park and Sandon ward. And as Jonathan knows, I'm never anybody who likes to take it easy. We were up for election 12 months later. The council was kind of being reconfigured. I was having a baby at the same time. So we go into the county in 2011. We were a group of seven, I think, Conservatives and a council of 60. And on that night, every one of my colleagues lost their seats. I was the only Conservative re-elected on Stoke-on-Trent City Council, heavily pregnant. Lots of worried faces in the room that night. But I was joined by a young man, Who was 18, I think, at the time, which was a seat that we won, and that is now my MP, Jack Brayton. And,
and
that's kind of where the story then picks up from the, you know, how you very kindly introduced me, Jonathan.
Well, we're going to have, listeners will be sick to death by hearing Stoke on Trent by the end of this episode, which is my favourite topic, of course, of all. And that's the, that story.
Well, there's only two of us on the pod who are actually from that, but
Well, okay, well, James, I mean, that's unfair. My children are born and bred there. So now what I will say is that, funny enough, you talked about the BNP, actually, I had a debate this week as we're recording in Westminster Hall, and Jack and I were both talking about the Khan review that looked at extremism. We talked about the very sad rise, because essentially when mainstream political parties of all colours vacated the field and the people in the areas like Stoke-on-Trent felt that their views, concerns around levelling up, as we're going to talk about today with you, but also around issues like immigration, which will matter to people around there, then sadly those extreme elements are able to grip hold of the situation.
Absolutely.
And I think that actually, I will generally say this, if people look at Stoke politics close enough, it will be Abby and Jack teaming up, working with Gavin, who then rebuilt essentially Stoke Conservatives and made sure that the BNP were kicked into the long grass, thank God. And now we have centre, mainstream, political parties battling it out as it should be, and the extremes of the
But do you agree with that, Abby, that that's the reason, that was the cause of the rise of the BNP was people, that would be a kind of common theory, which is the mainstream politics ignored a range of issues.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I grew up in Newcastle under Lyme, which is a neighbouring borough, and I remember when I was a kid, we would have one leaflet through the door at election time. It would be for the Labour candidate. Nobody ever knocked on the door. And people would vote for them. And I think that instills in people very much a sense of what to expect, that the council's perhaps not really interested in you. And that was the same in Stoke. I think we're probably a few years behind some of the things that I learned as a young activist in Newcastle. I then took to Stoke and tried to do there as well. But it was that was very much the sense. That was the sense that I got from the incumbent councillors, from the Labour Party, but also from our Conservative group. We were put out a leaflet at election time. We literally would cross our fingers and hope we were going to win. And that's not how you win elections. So then is it any surprise that people don't really engage with you? They don't really know who you are, what you stand for. And to a degree as well, I think for certainly one of the reasons I got involved was that we looked how people expected the Conservative Party to look. You know, we looked like white middle-class people who own businesses, and that's great. That's, you know, that's my background. That's what my dad did. He didn't own a suit. I think he only still owns one suit today. Jonathan would love my dad.
It's very sound.
But I stood because nobody looked like me. Somebody who, you know, I'm first generation in my family to go to university, come from a very kind of blue collar background. My husband and I both wanted to stay locally. We live in quite a deprived area in Stoke-on-Trent, but we wanted to stay there, and we've invested in our house. We live in a nice house, got involved with things, you know, but I didn't see anybody like me who wanted to be aspirant, who was saying, actually, I don't want to move away. I want to stay here, and I want to see great things happen in this place that I really love.
Totally. And look, I think if you look at Stoke Conservatives, when I first turned up in 2018, it's actually quite a young group that's been put together there. And obviously, you know, difficult times and last year's local elections, but ultimately still returning 14 councillors, which is second best result that we've ever had at election time. So positive news for those of us who are Conservatives.
But can we do some basics first?
Yeah, sure.
And I want to definitely get into kind of, I'm really interested on your views on levelling up. I would love to get into a bit of that, because I've seen you speak on levelling up as well, including kind of how it relates to health and so on. And that's just going to be a big topic for years, whatever people call it. But in terms of your role, so we've talked a bit about local government before between ourselves and with different people. I think, you tell me if I'm wrong, I'll give you a straw man if you like.
Okay.
So I don't think people fundamentally always understand what their MP's in charge of, what the local council is in charge of, what's the difference between a leader, a chief executive, all these kinds of things? You were a leader of a council. And so I wonder if you could kind of give me an overview of what did your role as that entail? What does it entail now? What are you actually, what levers? I think that's the way to put it in politics. What are the actual levers you have to pull to deal with some of those things that you mentioned that are issues in Stoke?
So we'll talk about Stoke-on-Trent because it's probably a fairly easy sort of unit to understand. So Stoke-on-Trent is a city of 265,000 people spread across six towns. It's broken into wards. We're a unitary council, which means that in effect there is no parishes or anyone underneath us. We do everything. I heard Jonathan describe this a few weeks ago on the pod as doing everything from litters through to social care. Mm. So as leader of the council, we were a £500 million turnover organisation, and we oversee everything from emptying your bin and disposing of the rubbish right the way through to looking after vulnerable children, homeless people, taxi licensing, adult social care, roads, you name it, we do it. Mm. And you're doing that within your geography, but I'm a strong advocate as well that there is also then the ability to engage with government around that. So, you know, I would often say that, you know, Boris Johnson, Rishi Sunak didn't have a direct hotline to me. So, you know, people kind of very keen to say, you know, we're conservative, you must know about all this. Mm. And actually, you know, you don't have direct conversations with government to say this is what we should do. But obviously through things like the LGA, you have a broader conduit to them. But I was also a very keen advocate of my ability to influence by simply having working with my MPs, but also putting forward opinions. You know, I'm not there to do what the government tells me to do. I'm there to work in partnership with the government to deliver those services in my area. And yes, they give me some cash to do that, but I also give them feedback back. And for me, the secret was building a partnership, building that narrative. And some of our success that I'm sure we'll talk about was based on how you build that partnership rather than just basically do what you're told.
Mm. I will say one thing. Abby is incredibly sharp-elbowed, which I think was actually very important, particularly for what Stoke is. These unitary councils, you'll hear them, for example, in place, I may be using the wrong example, but Surrey, for example, these much larger geographically located areas. Stoke is what we call a small unitary authority because of the size of the population and the geography. But what Abby, I thought, did very successfully, and which any council leader of any colour should always do, is make sure they get a direct line, whether that be to the Secretary of State for Levelling Up Housing Communities, whether it be the Prime Minister themselves, but making sure that they themselves have a direct link. So it's not always coming through the MP, who will have their own mailbag, their own issues, their own campaigns that they'll want to talk about as well, in order for that relationship to be really strong and important. When it comes to the chief executive of a council, or in our case in Stoke, we have a city director as the official title. How does that relationship work? Is the city director reporting to you, or do they have certain powers that they just crack on and do things and you kind of oversee it every now and again?
So it's kind of somewhere in the middle of that. Most councillors are your normal person who walks down the road. That's who I am. You know, I'm not an accountant or a solicitor. You know, my background was basically politics in a way and understanding how politics worked. As Jonathan knows, had a varied career kind of history. I've delivered flowers, I've worked in retail, done all sorts of kind of not terribly exciting jobs, just really passionate about my place. When you become the leader of the council, in effect, you become the line manager for the chief exec, and he employs everyone else. In Stoke, that's a workforce of around 4,000 people delivering all those services that I talked about. And he employs specialists beneath him, to oversee social work, to oversee highways and all those sorts of things. As the leader, and certainly my interpretation of leadership, is that I needed to have quite a good handle across all of that, but I'm not an expert. I employ experts who give me advice, and I make a decision on that. And that, you know, the secret of all this is to get into a place where you may have you're going to have political views or just common sense views about stuff, and you're working with the chief exec who can kind of understand where you're coming from and can help you to find a way through that and understands what your approach is to doing those things, and therefore how the advice becomes appropriate for you to be able to make that decision. A pretty good example would be, in the broadest sense, I wanted to engage really strongly with the government, and I wanted to work with officers who were able to support me to do that, to be able to come up with some of the stuff that you've heard me talk about around levelling up and how we would want to approach that as a city. Not all leaders want to do that. Some just want to concentrate on doing the bread and butter in their place. And you know what? That's absolutely okay if that's what you want to do. But I didn't. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to use this opportunity because, you know, we kind of alluded to this, but I never, ever expected to be anything other than a backbench councillor, because the Conservatives have never been a significant force in Stoke-on-Trent. We'd always had relatively small numbers. You know, we'd maybe been influential in the odd thing here or there. But this was the moment when I became the deputy leader of the council in 2015. Every day I skipped up that corridor to my office, because every day was a new opportunity to make a difference in a role that I never thought I could do to influence all these things. So for me, it was very much about how do you not only do the good stuff in your place, but equally, how do you make a change for the future? And how can you almost kind of, I didn't think about it as a legacy, but in a way, how can I leave a legacy around what someone who's not Labour in a way could do here?
I think what's really interesting as well is, if for those who aren't aware, in Whitehall, you have civil servants. We call them officers in local authorities. There's also a similar kind of structure, as you say. We've got the chief executive or city director. You have the cabinet secretary, the sort of who oversees, or the permanent secretary oversees the entire cabinet. We also have a situation where you, as a political leader, can create your own cabinet, just like a prime minister can create his cabinet. And we have committees as well that hold the governing group or coalition, whoever it is, to hold, as we do with select committees here in Whitehall as well. So there is a parallel. Now, what's it like trying to, do you have the same headaches as the Prime Minister? Everyone thinks that they should be in the cabinet. And at the end of the day, how easy is it for those councillors? Because whereas in a cabinet minister is already a member of parliament, they have staff, the private office, and a decent salary, a very good salary in order to be able to do that job. Obviously much more challenging with a council where they won't be receiving the same amount of financial remuneration.
I think there's the same level of headache. And, you know, the analogy that I would compare it to, and it is the same in Parliament, albeit on a much bigger scale, is that this isn't like a normal job where actually, do you know what, I don't think you're very good, I'm going to sack you and I'm going to get somebody else. Sacking somebody in that sense is in effect causing an election, and then you're going to keep your fingers crossed, aren't you? You're going to get the right person with the right qualifications to come forward. So there is a case of an element of doing the best with what you've got, which I think has probably been, you know, a core principle of mine all the way through this, having kind of worked for Conservative councils in the past. So there is an element, I guess, of trying to match people up. And sometimes, you know, I reflect back on some of the decisions that I made around appointing people. Sometimes I would put people into roles where actually they got no background in that role, but actually you saw something in them. You saw that they got the ability to want to grasp something, or they were passionate if you were going to give them something really difficult to do, or actually there was somebody who was just going to be really reliable and crack on and do stuff for you. So, yeah, an element of the headache around that. But, you know, councils are relatively small. You know, I think the biggest one in the country at the moment is Buckinghamshire, which is just over 100. That's about to come down a bit. But, you know, it comes with its own challenges, doesn't it? You know, you might have a bigger number, perhaps, of people to play with, but you're still a relatively limited pool. And then when you think about the other challenges, as Jonathan says, councillors generally are not full-time. Mm. Most of us will have some sort of other responsibility, even if it's caring, and even if you decide to be full-time, the geography restrictions mean that, and because you don't have staff, it's still a burden. You know, you're still not quite in the same as an MP where you can be here in the sort of same way. So I think, you know, you've got to work around all of those things. Some people want to do it, you know, want to go on the cabinet, you know, and then you also have to factor in all those people who maybe want to use being a councillor as a stepping stone to something else, and therefore what limitations have got on their own time around all this.
Do you think it's... This might be unfair, but do you think it's a good... Do you think the system could be improved as it is? Because, as you said, councillors, leaders of councils, are responsible for sizable budgets, a lot. And actually, in political terms, probably a lot of the things that most affect people directly affect people's daily lives. You know, anyone that's worked in politics will know, like, if you just knock on doors, the things that are... Of course, they raise bigger issues, but it will be like bin collections and potholes will come up all the time. But we expect people to do two jobs, to be maybe doing that and caring. We don't give them the staff that maybe they need. But at the same time, you know, the public don't really, you know, maybe tell the difference between what you did as leader and what Jonathan and Jack and Joe did as MPs, and where's the lines. So do you think should that system be improved? And how?
So I would say yes, because I think, you know, I was very fortunate in that my family circumstance at the time meant that I was able to give more time to do things, certainly the time that I was leader. But, you know, when I became deputy leader, I think my youngest child hadn't entered school. My husband was working away to a degree, so I was kind of managing to juggle things between school hours, doing things. And the public don't have a huge amount of sympathy necessarily for that. But I've also been quite a big advocate, I would say, that we need to actually speak up for ourselves. There is a difference, I think, between being whiny. Nobody wants to hear politicians saying, "Woe is me." You know, I did choose to do this at the end of the day. Mm. But I also think it is important that we educate the public around that. And, you know, as Jonathan will know, myself and a number of my colleagues were often quite outspoken around some of the issues when people would write to you and they would mistakenly think that you are drawing an allowance into six figures. You know, the reality is, and, you know, Jonathan, well done the other day. Again, you mentioned on the pod, in Stoke-on-Trent, an allowance for a city councillor is £12,000. That's pretty average. If you were in a two-tier area, again, you know, part of Jonathan's constituency has got a county and a district. Across the two, again, if you are doing a county council role and a district council role, you're probably, again, bringing in £12,000, which might seem like a lot of money, but then when you think, you know, again, it's not hugely different from being an MP in that you never know when you might be contacted. I was out walking the other morning on a Sunday morning with my husband and I got residents contacting me. And yeah, I can let it go to voicemail if I want to, but I can also see on social media them same people commenting saying, I called her at 10 o'clock and
I don't think it is at all. I mean, look, so obviously it's full-time, it's a different job, but in my sector, and you know, it is full-time, but the most junior person in the company will get paid double that.
Yeah.
So, and I realise it's a different dynamic with people being able to do other jobs, the personnel company can't. But I think just in terms of who... You people that are councillors, broadly speaking, are doing it for public service. They're clearly not doing it for money.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think, you know, when I was leader of the council, about £45,000, really. And I would probably say I was pretty good value for that in terms of the hours that
And that's the thing for me, £45,000 a year for £500 million a year budget. Mm. I mean, no company of that size would be paying their head honcho, essentially, that level of money. And I think, as we've just all said, when I think back, I see the councillors, I've seen Abby, the phone calls come in, there's the meetings with local community groups and local charities, there's the meetings with officers to overview and scrutiny of what's going on. Then there's the visiting Mrs. A at her house because the hedge hasn't been trimmed or the grass needs cutting. Then there's Mr. B down the road who's got a pothole outside. Then there's Mrs. C again who says that their child hasn't had their EHCP through. This is very complicated stuff that I'm, as an MP, able to be across much more in the detail of, because one, I've got access to ministers much more easily and departments. I've also got a team of staff, both in London and in the constituency, who can pick up and share the load. The councillor has none of that. Mm. You know, I have a phone at my office, but councillors have to normally supply their mobile phone number so residents can get in touch. There is no peace. I do think that there has to be a serious think about what we want from our councillors and how we can make sure that councillors feel that they're able to deal with, because there's a lot of people that I think, when I talk to them, who would love to go into being a counsellor. The same question, Abby, I'm sure you hear all the time, is how can I juggle time? Financially, can I take the hit potentially if I'm going to have to reduce my hours in my current job? And thirdly, can I deal with trying to be across it all on my own?
So I think, you know, I would say certainly, you know, it's the same as Parliament. You form a group normally. Even when there was two of us and there was Jack and I, you know, there's a lot of conversation around what you do. And, you know, I always view it's about leadership, isn't it? You know, that you support people. I desperately want certain people to do more. How can I help them? And that could be everything from finding them somebody to help them through the first difficult 12 months of working out what's going on, right the way through to maybe creating roles to support them to do stuff. And if I'm honest, I think most councils are pretty good at understanding what support new councillors need to go in there. And actually, you know, there is the ability to build in support. I had an absolutely amazing PA for 8 years who was able to filter a lot of those kind of minor sort of queries out, arrange meetings for me and stuff like that. But yeah, I think some of this is about the public also understanding that you are actually genuinely trying to do other things. Yeah. And, you know, I've been around politics for long enough to know the amount of hassle that MPs get. But to a degree, it's the same for councillors. You know, I go shopping in the Tesco in my ward and you never know who's looking at what you're buying. She's a bit too long in the Prosecco aisle, isn't she, Councillor Brown?
know. That would definitely be true, though, by
the way.
I would definitely back that up.
Well, do you know, Jonathan, how important it is to have someone good to manage your diary, I think? But on the...
Don't rile Harry.
You've touched, I think, one way as well to look at the difference in roles, and which I think will lead us into levelling up, is you mentioned a few times that one of the ways you saw your role is the interaction with central government. And then the conduit to that is perhaps, correct, if I've interpreted correctly, is working with the MPs locally. Jonathan, Jack Berriton, Joe Gideon in your area, I imagine. And so how does that work? Like, how were you able to get stuff out of government? You know, the last few years, particularly with Boris Johnson, have seen this levelling up funding, monies available to councils that can be bid on in the various funds.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you could give us even a specific example, like how does that work? The government says, we're going to announce X pot of money. What can you then do to give your council and yourself the best chance of securing some of that for Stoke?
So I think there's kind of two bits there. I think one of it is about your personal approach. And I've talked about how, for me, becoming deputy leader was a moment in time where suddenly I had lots of doors being opened for me. I've probably been lucky, but I also believe that you make a lot of your own luck. I'm an absolute sod for taking opportunities that were there, and I know that used to drive people really crazy to begin with until they sort of realised that that started to come to fruition. You know, because I think as a party, the Conservatives had never expected to have anybody in Stoke-on-Trent. Immediately, the doors to things started to open to me, so I became the deputy leader in the May. And in the October that year, Greg Clark had got me on the stage for his conference set, a party conference, because somebody had introduced me to him. And I think I've probably been quite lucky, partially, but also made my own luck. You turn up at stuff. I ask questions at seminars. Even though I know the answer and the person on the stage knows me, everybody else in the room suddenly knows me as well then, don't they? And they also know I come from Stoke-on-Trent because the question's always about Stoke-on-Trent. So you build those connections that way. You build an element of notoriety in a way. And again, you know, I think very few female Conservative council leaders, let alone ones who were prepared to do some of the stuff that I was going to do blatantly. So you start off with an element that people know you, and then I guess I would say about the MPs, for me, it was almost like another 4 years the same again. Suddenly, yes, I've become the leader now. I never thought I'd be the leader. And I've got three people with me who were experiencing exactly what I was experiencing 4 years ago, which is I never thought I'd be doing this. And I think, you know, we are very different characters amongst the four of us. But it became very clear that we all recognised a huge opportunity to come together, to build on not only the head start that I'd kind of had with Jack in Stoke. Jack had been elected in 2017, of suddenly where these two guys come from? There's now four of us. We've just painted the entire Stoke-on-Trent blue. We 8 years ago, these people literally sat in their own on the corner, and now they are our face. And I think we wasted absolutely no time in sort of forming our own ideas, working out how we were going to work together, and actually deciding what it was we were going to go for. And, you know, I've had a lot of time, you know, I haven't led a council now for 12 months to reflect back on the things I didn't do right. But some of the things that I think I did do right was actually the four of us getting together really quickly and deciding what we were going to go for, and also what we weren't going to go for. I think it was probably more about what we were going to go for, but I think we were very clear that it got to be the four of us. And it had to be that sort of pushiness in our own individual ways of how we were going to be not forgotten, really. And equally, I think, you know, we held the national zeitgeist a number of times over those 4 years for a variety of different things that we were doing, sometimes on our own, but in conjunction with the others, and sometimes all together.
Abby used a phrase early on that I thought was very clever that Jack, Joe and I repeated in debates, which I think was helpful, was levelling up, of course, was such a dominant thing when Boris has come in. So Abby came up with the phrase of Stoke-on-Trent will be the litmus test for the government's levelling up agenda. And therefore, by repeating that over and over again in communications from Abby and then Jack, Joe and I think politically, using the political element of what we could do, we kind of made that, made our own fortune in that regard of saying to government, if you don't get it right here, then it will be seen as a failure because of the seismic fact that Stoke had gone blue entirely for the first time because of its location at the very top of the West Midlands, as I always call it, the gatekeepers to the northern powerhouse, and a city that, you know, was a huge leave area, for example, an area that really resonated with that levelling up agenda. And I think that was really important. Yeah. And I think that actually Abby made a good point. You know, Joe and I in particular were newbies. I'd been in Stoke around November 18. I came in, Abby knows me, when she has different personalities, definitely have different styles in how we go things. And I remember coming in and I think I wanted money for every single thing going, Abby having to temper expectation versus reality, what could and could not be done. And actually even myself having to learn about what the city council's own ability to use their own finances, but also strong arm in other people. And I think if you look at one of our projects, the Goods Yard, Kaplan Centric are the company. Abby was the first one to get Kaplan Centric, a very big development company, to leave the Northwest to come to the West Midlands. And actually, because of that, Newcastle under Lyme is now benefiting because they're now taking part in a project. And in fact, Kaplan Centric have approached me about Charlie Whitfield Colliery. So I think it's about that relationship and that narrative was able to anchor the private sector to take a much wider interest in Stoke.
Let me pause you there and ask both of you. So one thing I think we've seen, levelling up has been a huge topic in the national political discourse, but it's also been criticised for not being clear enough about what it actually means. And so I'm curious to ask both of you, two people who have been heavily involved in trying to level up Stoke, bidding on levelling up funds, talking to voters about levelling up. Who want to go? You go first, Jonathan.
Go on.
Give us, if a constituent says to you, what is levelling up? Can you explain it to them in three sentences?
Levelling up is about improving the educational outcomes of our local area and the health outcomes so that people can access new high-skilled and high-wage jobs that will ultimately come from a better skilled population. That means the private sector will take places like Stoke-on-Trent much more seriously to set up their HQs or second homes in our area. And then once that local economy booms, then we'll be able to further invest in our towns, in our high streets, in our roads, which means we can bring the long-awaited regeneration that people have wanted.
Abby, do you agree with that?
Yeah.
Is that how you would sum it up? Would you add or...
No, I think pretty much in the same place. It means that actually a kid like me who grew up in Stoke-on-Trent in a mining village can go on to be just as successful as somebody elsewhere. And, you know, how do we do that? I think one of the things that we were particularly good at, and maybe it's a Stokey thing, you know, because Jonathan is basically a Stokey now.
Stokey.
We were very creative in how we did that, you know, and the way that we did it. I don't think we behaved in the way that people expected politicians to act in terms of doing that. One of the things, I don't know why I'm suddenly thinking about this, is the time that Jonathan and I went to the football together. And we went to the Vale together.
Yeah.
And we went in the railway stand. And I bought the tickets. I'd arranged a little trip for reviews because there's been a bit of a discussion because we used to do loads of... We still do lots of campaigning, but we were very hardcore. One of the first times I met Jonathan was when he came campaigning with us. A friend of mine, Bobby Alden, who leads the Conservative group in Birmingham, had said to Jonathan, you want to go see some really good campaign, you want to go to Stoke and meet the Conservatives there. So every Saturday morning we'd be out. Lots of conversation. We'd be all over the city working together. Conversation, let's go to the football. You were an MP at this point, I think, but I'd booked the tickets.
Yeah.
And there was about five or six of us, and we went in the railway stand. So for anyone who knows the Vale, that, and we went down the rough end of the railway stand.
Right.
And I remember getting a bit of earache from the owner of the club, actually, who was like so unhappy with us that we'd gone there. And I remember getting a bit of stick from somebody on social about, and you were getting the stick actually, and I was defending you. Because my money is as good as anybody else's money, and why shouldn't I go to the Vale and support a team? And you've made a judgment on me because you think I'm a Conservative, that you think I don't care.
Yeah.
And, you know, my husband's family have been heavily involved with the Vale over the years, and you know nothing about me. Don't make a judgment. But, you know, levelling up is about how we sort of make a change for people. It wasn't actually about being a Conservative. It was about caring about the place and how we would articulate that and how we would creatively take that challenge forward by talking about football. In a different way, by talking about culture, which was, you know, a big thing that I'd done for a few years in the city, by talking about people's lives, education, and just being normal people, really.
Out of interest, you've talked obviously about the political element and how, you know, Jack, Joe, yourself and I worked to set the narrative. What I'm also keen to understand is with these levelling up bids, what's it like being a leader of the council working with officers? Like how much, we always hear this term red tape and bureaucracy. And obviously, part of the criticism for all these funds is it's been a lot of bureaucracy, a lot of form filling. It's cost a lot of money to councils just to bid into this pot of funding. Mm. What was it like for all the different pots? We've had, what, Towns Deal, Levelling Up Fund, Levelling Up Partnership Fund, and so forth.
I think it is frustrating. And obviously, part of my role that I do now is talk on behalf of the Local Government Association around the challenges for councils in having to do that and the fact that you don't necessarily employ the people who do it. I think some of this, though, again, is back to trying to understand how you instill a wider mindset across local government leaders to think about their opportunities to do things. And, you know, in a very basic form, that means that when the government says some money to bid for, what project can you go and get off the shelf and say this would be doable? So, you know, you mentioned Chatwit already. You know, I know you've put a huge amount of effort into understanding what the most complete former colliery site in the UK could be in the future. Now, that could be a huge piece of work, but actually Jonathan's been key in championing the fact that we've made a really good start on that to understand what it could be. And some of the challenge for councils is that actually when the government says, what could you do for this pot of money, 20 million quid, let's say, they've got lots of ideas, but got nothing written down. And it's hard because to get the money to do that, you've got to say, I'm not going to do something else.
Mm.
But ultimately, isn't that what leadership's about? It's understanding what your place is going to be like. Yeah.
Fundamentally.
So we work quite hard on understanding that. But the other part of it was also understanding what we weren't going to do. You know, I wouldn't say the mad things, but what are the things that are further down the line? And again, it sounds like I'm sucking up to Jonathan. I have to say, we have argued a lot over the 4 years, so it's not, we haven't always
When he leaves, we'll get into some of this.
but Chatterley Whitfield is a massive project, and so having to say to Jonathan, I know you bloody love Chatterley Whitfield, and it is great, it's an amazing site, but there is no way I'm going to get this off the ground.
Mm.
Actually, the Good Yard, that will be the project that I can get off the ground first, but I will support you to make baby steps.
Mm.
Because that's important too. It's important that we have a wider, longer-term view, Because do you know what? Jonathan and I might not be here in 50 years' time, but we will leave behind a legacy of having planned for our area and thought about what the future might look like a little bit. And I didn't inherit that. I didn't inherit any real groundwork around that. So a lot of the things that we did were things that we had to get together quite quick. There is a cost. The levelling up stuff was costly. We gambled a huge amount on it. Not eye-watering sums, but, you know, if we hadn't have secured those bids,
I'd have probably been
toast. Mm-hmm. You know, but we were, and I have, you know, said before, probably it gets round and everything else, probably the hardest decision that we made and the moment that I had almost the most respect I've ever had for my three MPs was the moment that we had to sit in a room and decide what we were going to bid for, because we saw other places around the country saying, you know, you've got three constituencies, you get three bids, so that'll be one each. And we collectively made a decision, and it was the MPs who led this, it wasn't me, who said, actually, we don't want to do that, we want to do this. And that is just, I think for me, that is the moment that says we were a collection of people that were more about our individual desire to want to be, you know, the MP for Stoke North, Kidsgrove and Talk Forever, or the leader of the council forever. This was about what is the legacy that the four of us will deliver for Stoke-on-Trent that says this is what levelling up is for us.
I hadn't thought of it like that, but you're right. That was, I think, a breakthrough moment for us as a four in terms of really figuring out how we worked, because there were so many projects I wanted in Stoke North specifically, so many barriers. For example, a lot of the buildings in Burslem are Grade 2 listed, beautiful, but come at a huge price tag, and ultimately the economy with COVID and everything else just was not in the place to be able to attract private sector investment. And the reality of going, actually, we need to... The problem for Stoke, I've always found, is that we're still very much in the mindset of the six towns, and every town still wants to be the city centre, and they want to have their nighttime and a daytime economy, and all can live side by side. But the reality is that the way we now shop, the way we now interact, the way we now socialise just doesn't allow or enable that to happen. And so, yeah, I think it was quite big, because a lot of the funding went into Stoke Central constituency. I think for Jack, obviously, he'd been working very hard since 2017 to get money, and I felt he'd been overlooked, for example, with town deal funding when he didn't get it, even though actually he was kind of like the author of that idea. And understanding, obviously, I was kind of banging the drum of Stoke North's going to determine who wins the country next. We need to make sure we're parting money into Burslem and Tunstall if we're going to convince people to keep with us. And I think that was a breakthrough moment for us as a four. And I think actually that goes back to that importance of the relationship you have with your councillors and council leader, regardless of political colour, and the MP, so that local area. And one thing I will say is that, to be fair to the new leader of the city council, she has at least kept up the quarterly meetings, so there is an opportunity for MPs and the leader to have.
Well, I was going to ask you both.
James, I'm going to be rude because I've got a PMQ. You've got your PMQ. So I've got to go. I will leave the listeners now in your fine hands with that.
Can I take a wild guess and guess it's going to be on immigration?
I think that you know that because I was asking your advice on the question. But yeah, thank you very much for that.
Oh, have fun. So you talked about the legacy aspect of levelling up, and I think another question, you get questions about what it actually means, but I think there's now going to, with the general election coming up, there's going to be and we've had a big change in leadership. Boris was probably the poster boy for it. What do you think the future for levelling up, or what everyone calls it, is going to be? Because I think, while you've both described what it is, the causes were basically, and tell me if you disagree, significant parts of the country had essentially, to one degree or another, been ignored and left, and politically hadn't been given much attention, certainly not much money. There's now a political focus on that. Do you think that is there to stay, no matter who comes in? Do you see a commitment from it? I'm not asking you to praise Labour or Starmer or Cover Council. Do you think that is now part of political discourse, or could we lose it?
I think,
which is really important for Stoke.
I think we could lose it. I think it's important that people like me, who were leaders and are leaders of places like Stoke and the other places that strongly, you know, saw themselves as being part of that kind of levelling up agenda, continue to push. I think what's also happened, though, is there's a wider discourse that it's not just north versus south or rural versus urban. It is about actually things that were overlooked, you know, whether it's education, whether it's health, whether it's investment. And they are going to differ all over the country, and they're going to differ between those synonymous levelling up places. So I think it could potentially be lost. I would like to hope that it's still here, because certainly my feel within local government circles is it's still talked about quite a lot. I think it's kind of opened our eyes to the narratives we should be pushing, actually, and the influence actually that we can have as local leaders in terms of influencing government policy around that. I think the challenge for any government is to kind of get to the root of how they do that. You know, you could end up with, you know, 300 local authorities just in England alone. You know, how do you sustain 300 different conversations? Well, they don't have to be 300. You could agglomerate them if you wanted to. But I think it's the government needing to understand that there is that level of sophistication there. And equally for places to understand that too, and respond accordingly. But, you know, for me, the onus is on local government to ensure that this continues to be something that we say we want to talk about.
So you think it needs to be a push from local government to national politicians? So how is it within the LGA then, for example, with the local government association?
I think there is a significant amount of discussion around that. You know, we are working at the moment on a white paper for the incoming government and to lobby governments and lobby political parties in the run-up to the general election. And place is quite a significant component of that,
right,
in terms of where we...
That's a white paper on local government overall.
Yeah. What we would like to see in the incoming government, of whichever colour they are, the new relationship with local government as a result of that.
So in the LGA, is that cross-party?
Yes.
Yeah. So obviously, by the time this goes out, we'd have had the local. So
yeah,
you'll be all bitterly fighting your, you know, opposition numbers. But just sticking with levelling up, but on any aspect you want to draw in. So within the LGA, it's the case, though, that, you know, you might have as much in common to fight for this as with any of your Labour counterparts. So that will continue. So if we do get a Labour government, that's something that collectively the people within the LGA, you would still imagine they would push on?
Yes, yeah. I think, look, the LGA, in a way, is kind of quite similar to local government, but it's not. Although there are four political groups, and, you know, and they are of varying sizes. Today, the Labour group is the biggest group, so they have the chairman. What I certainly find is that there is a huge amount more in common across us all than there is at a local level. So the discussion tends to be much more strategic around what we think is collectively important. And I would say certainly as well amongst those council leaders who are and other senior council involved with the LGA, is it's quite progressive. I think, you know, one of the really interesting things that's come about in the last few years, and, you know, we touched on this kind of earlier, and one of the reasons that I got involved with the LGA is that actually, and he is a really nice man, I'd just like to say now, the man who is the leader of Surrey County Council, who's a friend of mine, he is a nationally recognised politician, he's involved with the LGA, and he does work really hard, but he's probably got a great many fewer things to worry about than when I was leader of Stoke-on-Trent City Council. But if we only let the leaders of Surrey County Council and other well-run councils that have got lots of time maybe on their hands because they haven't got as many issues set the agenda, then local government will only look like those places. And for me, it was really important that the local government discussion looked as much like places like Stoke that had come from nowhere, that were, as Jonathan described, having this argument about place amongst themselves, that had got a different sort of leadership that nobody expected, that was suddenly capturing the national zeitgeist. But actually, do you know what? A huge amount of challenge too. I got children's services and intervention. I kept them away from a Section 114 bankruptcy notice for 8 years. All those other things going on as well. I had to make time to go and be part of the national discourse. You know, and I think that continues, and I think that's what we see at the moment in local government, that actually... I wouldn't say everybody's opinion is valid, but actually there's a wider view of opinion, not just council leaders, whatever colour, from places where the leader's got loads of time to go and do stuff like the LGA. Actually, it's important that all those voices are heard.
Because I imagine, for example, social care, I imagine there's a lot of consensus among... Yeah. I imagine a lot of councils know what they want from both... imagine the LGA could be quite united in telling both parties...
Yes,
because essentially it's a. I mean, you will know better, but it's an issue. My perception would be it's an issue that both parties kind of want to leave to the councils, and say, well, you've got some money to do this, and councils are all saying, whether you're Labour, Lib Dem, or Tory, we don't have the cash to do this, and so it doesn't matter if you've got quite a wealthy area, you've probably still got quite a big problem. Things like that, you can get consensus.
Absolutely, I think, you know, the only kind of difference is maybe sometimes in the way that you express that, but there is really very little difference. As you say, you know, adult social care is a really good one. Children's social care, the same. Special educational needs, again, is another big issue where actually there is almost no difference between any of the political groups on the LGA. It's perhaps more the ferocity of the attack and the way that it's pitched often. You know,
because it's political.
But again, you know, I think there are swings and roundabouts with that, aren't there? You know, the organisation, the LGA, can say this. Our chairman is a Labour council leader at the moment, but actually as a Conservative group, we have a really strong relationship with the Secretary of State. So actually we might temper what the LGA says, but believe me, behind closed doors, we say what we think. Mm. But we do it behind closed doors because that is the most appropriate way of doing it. And actually that's the way I think that we all play, you know, in terms of, you know, have a good relationship with Jonathan, but there have been crosswords in the past, and it isn't necessarily true that just because you're on the same side, it makes it really easy. You know, you should still be having those honest conversations.
Mm. And what is the kind of dynamic with the MPs? So, what you don't, not to go into specifics if you don't want to, but what are the kind of where are the clash points? Where is it easier to agree, and where are the things that maybe whether it's Jonathan or Jack or any other MPs? Maybe they want something and that frustrates you, or you want them to do more. What kind of things would they be?
I think, you know, Jonathan gave a really good example earlier in terms of wanting things within his constituency, which I think kind of we can all understand.
Yeah.
Particularly in somewhere like Stoke, it is very challenging there, where you've got in effect six towns to look after that are spread across the city. It's always hard because you always have a favourite because you live in that area, really, yeah. or something else. And you know, you've got to try to deal with that yourself, as well as dealing with your MPs in a fair way. But you've also got to make sure the outcome's transparent. Mm. And even having three MPs of the same colour doesn't necessarily mean that it's any easier to do that. You know, they all have their own views that they would often have shared with me individually as yeah. well about what they thought the others were up to, or, you know, what they thought I should do. So, you know, it is kind of a bit of a, I'm going to say, you know, you need quite a lot of wisdom. I'm not sure I necessarily had a lot of wisdom, but I probably did on reflection to manage to keep us all kind of together.
So you're managing them a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. But I think, you know, as I say, the levelling up decision that we were going to go for what we went for was kind of the moment that I think we all recognised that we hadn't squabbled, but inevitably there was squabbling that went on. But, you know, the levelling up decision happened quite early in our time together. So I think that was the kind of the moment where we realised that we'd got something together, that particularly when we were successful. And I think then you look back and you think, actually, do you know what? It's really not worth a fight over that, is it? Because look, we've done all this together, and that's going to be the legacy that carries us through.
And so to end, I'm curious. So we've had various people on the pod. Some have worked relatively closely with Jonathan, some less so. You've worked very closely with him for a while. So I think, since he's not here, we can just talk about
it. Oh, yeah.
I think he's kind of developed a caricature outside, but you've worked with him closely, you see how passionate he is, we talked about Stoke. So I wonder if you could just give us a bit of an insight into having worked with him specifically over those past few years on Stoke. Like, how have you found working with him and seen, you've probably seen him, I've seen him as well, because I've known him for 8 years on and off, you know, develop as coming in as a new MP and kind of get used to it. And you've kind of almost done a bit of that together, I guess.
Well, there's certainly never a dull moment with Jonathan Gunn.
We should both agree on that.
I guess what I would say in a wider context, you know, and as I sort of alluded to in some of the things we talked about earlier, you know, I've been around for a very long time, and I've known lots of people within that time period, from MPs who I knew before they were MPs. Some of those MPs have been cabinet ministers. I've been fortunate enough to know party chairman. Mm. I get to spend time with secretaries of state, some of whom I knew when they were candidates. Mm. And what you realise is that most people of all political persuasions are actually essentially good people. They care about where they live, they care about communities, and they want to enter politics for the right reason. But I think there is always also an element of sometimes trying to protect yourself within that, and who you are seen to be. And maybe you overemphasise some characteristics and underemphasise others. I think, you know, it's interesting you use the word caricature, because I think Jonathan at times can be a caricature of himself. Mm. There is not a moment that goes by when I see him when I just think I really must buy Jonathan a belt next time I'm passing a men's workshop. But he is essentially somebody that I think that people buy into.
Yeah.
You know, he is authentically what you see. Mm. You can have higher versions of that and lower versions of that. I've seen him at times when he's been incredibly, you know, kind to me. But I've also seen him kind of fighting it out in a way with me sometimes over decisions. But I think that's all driven by passion for his place and desire to want to do the right thing. And in a way, you know, I guess I take all that as one. And I know that essentially he's a good man, and he's been a real pleasure to work with him. And actually, people will say to me, but aren't you embarrassed he does X or he does Y? Mm. And I think, but that's part of Jonathan and everybody's different. I'm sure I do stuff that really irritates him as well. But he has been a great MP for our area and he has been really good to work with. He's been challenging and he's pushed me at times, but I think he has also brought out the best in me. And I think, you know, that's some of what it takes to be a good team and to do good things, to have that challenge. Wouldn't it be really dull if we all just got on?
I know. I think, you know, I grew up a bit near Leek. And so obviously my dad's side of the family are all from there. I saw quite a few of them recently. And I think, although he's not from there, I feel like Brandon Lewis said to me once about looking for constituencies. He said, you know, the constituency finds you. And I think when I look at Jonathan and Stoke, I think he's quite a match for it. Like, you know, he kind of gets that. He's a fighter, which I think people, you know, I think people from Stoke are.
Yes.
he's passionate. He says what he thinks. People from Stoke are pretty direct in my experience.
Yeah.
And so I think he kind of found a constituency that suits him really well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's one of those things, isn't it, that the public like to talk about in terms of, you know, you should only kind of, you know, you're not a real Stokey. Well, you know, what is a real Stokey, actually? I was born in Stoke. I was born in the hospital there, but I spent the first 18 years of my life living just outside Stoke. So yeah. I would say I'm a North Staffordshire person. My mum's family come from Leek. My dad's family come from Stoke and Newcastle.
Yeah.
So I feel, you know, my husband's family the same, that I'm a proper North Staffordshire girl.
Yeah.
That I understand what it's like to live in a city. You know, I was privileged in my life to be able to lead the city for 4 years. But I also know what it's like to live in one of the areas around the city where maybe the city overshadows what's going on there that's also really special. Because again, you know, you and I are the same. Newcastle is slightly different to Leek, but it's a really proud area. It's proud of its history and the things that happen there. And it's a cracking little town as well. So I kind of feel that I get that. But Jonathan hasn't had any of that, but he's taken it all to his heart.
Mm.
And I think, you know, I remember in the run-up, and he talked about this, I think, on the pod that he talked about when he became a candidate. We spent an evening at Starbucks in Wollstanton where he literally pumped me for information for about 5 hours.
Really?
And he was writing it all down. And you think, that is amazing. And that's what you want, isn't it? You don't have to be born somewhere. You just have to feel it. It has to be in your heart. And I think it is. And, you know, I would often say to people when I was leader of the council who would maybe leave us to go somewhere else, that you will leave Stoke-on-Trent, but it will never, ever leave you. And, you know, people laugh at me, but they don't. You also see them do this. They turn over plates. They ask me what I'm doing, turn over stuff. It's made in Stoke-on-Trent.
Oh, if he turns over another plate in a restaurant, I'll kill him.
But my friends who've seen me do that, they now do that
really?
Too. Because that really means something to us, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, and I think Jonathan is, you know, he loves Stoke-on-Trent, and I hope that he continues to be one of our MPs, but I have no doubt whatsoever that relationship between Jonathan and Stoke-on-Trent is lifelong now.
Yeah, I don't think you can. That's been brilliant. Thanks so much for joining us, Abby. That was fascinating. Also makes me want to do an episode on the LGA as well, actually. I think we probably need to look at that. But that tour from Stoke, and we'll say to listeners as well, get up to Stoke. You should go. Yep. And if you do, make sure you get some pottery. Get an oat cake would be my advice.
Yep.
Bacon and cheese would be for me. So thanks for listening. Do leave us a rating. Do follow us on Twitter on Whitehall Pod UK. And look forward to seeing you again next time. Thank you.